From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief for The Economist. On our panel this week, Philippe Gély, who is the chief US correspondent for Le Figaro, and Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor. And here are the issues. In his first speech to the UN General Assembly, President Donald Trump made headlines with bombastic warnings to North Korea and Iran over nuclear weapons. He also said that world peace would be helped by a nationalist awakening, suggesting that other countries should follow his America First style. It was a week of natural disasters in the Western Hemisphere. A powerful earthquake has killed hundreds in Mexico, while Hurricane Maria was the latest massive storm to hit the Caribbean. And in Washington, Republicans in the Senate readied for another attempt to dismantle the Obamacare health law that is a key plank of Barack Obama's legacy. The vote will be a major test of the party's ability to take advantage of its control of Congress and the White House. So let's begin with what was always going to be a big event, which was President Donald Trump's first speech as president to the General Assembly of the United Nations, this gathering of world leaders. That's always a big deal when any American president sets out their vision. But this was not like other presidents. I think there was an expectation. There's a lot going on in the news as well. So if we can, let's break it into two halves. Let's talk about what was distinctive about Donald Trump's pitch to the world about how the United Nations should work, how nationalism might be a good thing. How he seemed to be suggesting that the United Nations was in some way founded to be a place where, you know, nationalism brought about world peace. I think there are historians who would look back at 1945 and say that's not exactly the spirit of the United Nations. But, you know, he was quoting President Truman, and he was quoting, you know, this idea of when countries' rulers listen to their people and build a strong economy and a strong society and strong families and look after their own country, just as he is an America First president, that somehow that is the path to what he called a great awakening of nations. So this was kind of a pitch, if you like, Philippe, for a kind of a benign nationalism as the correct role for the United Nations and the best way to world peace. Did that strike you as something that stood out in his speech?
Yes, definitely, especially in the temple of diplomacy and multilateralism. I think he might have confused a little bit nationalism, sovereignty, patriotism. All this is, you know, mixed in a kind of Trump soup, which in terms of political philosophy has striken me as being really very basic. But that said, I think it works. I think it works with his audience of Republicans. I think they love the posture. They love the swaggering. They love the fact that, you know, we are still the big guy on the block. And in the end, I think it works as well with a lot of countries where their translation of the conventional American foreign policy is and has always been, you can do whatever you want in your own country until I bother. And that's how I think they interpreted in the end Trump's speech.
Michael, there was a really odd thing, wasn't there, that at moments in the speech, you could have kind of closed your eyes and squinted and imagined that he was any Republican president, because he was talking about, you know, Venezuela, you know, having political prisoners and not having a free press, and talking about how America stands with, you know, countries that, you know, the citizens of brutal regimes, America is always on their side, you know, kind of Reaganish kind of things. But then at other moments, he was saying that America is not going to dictate to anyone how they want to choose their political system, and he was praising the Saudi Arabians. What was going on? Was there a kind of coherent philosophy to, I mean, if the United Nations has always had that trade-off between national sovereignty and universal values, and quite often that collides, and you have countries like the Chinese or the Russians over the years have said that sovereignty is much more important than universal values, where did Trump come down on that?
Solidly somewhere in the middle, I think. As you say, it's a very difficult thing, I think, in life and certainly in diplomacy, to avoid hypocrisy. and this sort of conflict between wanting to do the right thing, saying the right thing, that sort of thing. And that's where we have, and it's obvious that countries will do what's best for their own sovereign nations. I don't think that anyone's ever abdicated that sort of authority or that sort of morality in their diplomacy. But in the United Nations, where I think the object of the entire exercise is to subjugate to some extent your own country's maybe best interest for the sake of what is the better interest and outcome for the world at large. It's to discuss those very things. And I think the world is still a little bit shocked, even though he's been on the international stage now for 9 months. The specter of an American president talking in this way about putting up walls that keep things out and keep things in, where this nation has been the leader of the internationalist movement for 60 years, it's still a surprising thing. I think it's a disturbing thing to many, to Trump's base. I think it's a wonderful thing. They really do love the swagger, as you said, the bombast. The threats even that come on. I'm sure we're going to talk about those later. But in terms of being consistent on sovereignty versus multilateralism, it's still very unclear as to where he stands.
And Philippe, let's talk about there were two big kind of rogue nations that he was making a case for international coalitions to tackle them. We'll talk about North Korea in a moment, but let's not forget the very important subject of Iran. America is one of the world powers that signed a deal with the Iranians that if they freeze their nuclear weapons work, they could have sanctions lifted. There are various deadlines, as you know, that means Donald Trump has to think what he's going to do about this pact. You're from one of the great French daily newspapers. Your president, Emmanuel Macron, spoke at the United Nations this week. He also said some things about the Iran deal that conservatives here in Washington said, aha, you see, Donald Trump has convinced his allies and the French president is absolutely agrees with him that the Iran deal is not enough, it's a bad deal. What was the message from an important ally like France, your country, when it comes to the Iran deal? And what do they think they heard from Donald Trump?
Well, the main message, as Emmanuel Macron explained, not only in his speech, but also in the press conference afterward, was that he said he had a conversation with Donald Trump on Iran, and he asked him, what do you put in the place of the deal if you destroy the deal? And he said, and I quote him, that I did not understand the answer. So basically, his argument was to explain to Mr. Trump that destroying the Iran nuclear deal would put Iran in a place where very close to North Korea, where it has very few solutions to offer.
And just for precision, obviously France and other big powers matter a lot because the claim from conservatives here in Washington is that if you tear up the Iran deal because they don't think that it is tough enough, that somehow you'll be able to renegotiate a better, tougher Iran deal. But of course, America isn't the only country that has a say in that. Do you think that countries like France, which has been tough on Iran, are they ready to renegotiate a brand new deal
No.
if Donald Trump tears this one up?
What they say is that they are ready to complete it with something else, covering maybe ballistic missiles, covering the behavior of Iran in the region, support to terrorism or rebellions in Yemen and elsewhere. They are ready to confirm the deal because they underline also that Donald Trump at the UN has not made the case of Iran not abiding to the deal. He hasn't said, look at what they are doing, and I have the proof that they are not abiding to their signature. What we have here is an American president feeling that he's not obliged to respect the signature of his own country. And that's the issue as far as the French and a lot of others go. But to try to accommodate Donald Trump, they are agreeing that there are issues that are not covered by the deal itself. So keep the deal and let's try to complete it and prolong it with another deal on other issues.
But no appetite for joining him in tearing up the deal and doing something
that
different.
So definitely.
He doesn't have allies on that.
I don't think so.
And that's a very important point. And Michael, one of the arguments that you have heard this week from people who worked for Barack Obama and who helped sign that Iran deal is if America walks away from that Iran deal, without proving that Iran is breaking the nuclear weapons terms, as Philippe absolutely, you know, correctly points out. So if the Iran deal is torn up, the argument we've heard this week from Democrats is if there's any hope of a diplomatic deal with North Korea, which is obviously a slim hope, what does it say if America is tearing up the only other nuclear deal with a rogue state that that it has on the table?
Well, I think it is a perfectly reasonable argument that a diplomat would make. And one of the issues still is that the top floor of the State Department is relatively barren. I mean, who is actually negotiating with North Korea? Who is affecting any level of diplomacy? Most of the diplomacy is taking place now in 140-character soundbites or text bites, if you will. This is not diplomacy. These are threats and bluster, and it obviously makes people, you know, quite scared and defensive about what's going to happen. That's no way to conduct a conversation. So I think when people, you know, make that argument that, yes, you know, it doesn't send a good signal. No, it doesn't send a good signal, but that's a sort of covert signal. We're sending some very overt signals that we have no intention of dealing with North Korea in what would typically be regarded a professional diplomatic manner.
And Philippe, we're going to go to a break soon, but just to tee up North Korea, we've seen extraordinary war of words. You know, Donald Trump said some very unusual things in the speech. Tell us what he said in the speech and tell us what we've just heard from Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, in response.
Well, in the speech, I don't think anyone missed that. He said that if the United States is threatened, they will destroy the entire country, which goes further than the usual, you know, diplomatic threat or even war declaration. I mean, usually you will say, I will destroy the regime that wants to attack me. And then there is this exchange of, you know, insults. I mean, dotard, madman, rocket man.
Yeah.
So on and so forth. And we are there at this point, and it's quite worrying that we have childish leaders playing with nuclear fire.
And we'll get back to that in just a minute. This is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, David Rennie, with The Economist. And joining me today are Philippe Gelly, the chief U.S. correspondent for Le Figaro, and Michael Williams, CBS Radio News contributor. This is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Listen to it, and then tell us what you think by taking a short survey on our Facebook page, Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. So, Philippe, I interrupted you in terms of talking about the two leaders throwing these insults. We've also had some serious news this week in terms of new sanctions. The Chinese central bank told Chinese banks not to do any business with North Korea. Donald Trump has issued a new executive order about sanctions. Tell us what's going on with these sanctions and how tough do they look?
Well, the central question here, it seems to me, is does it work? I mean, all this stuff and this tough talk from Donald Trump, all those sometimes ridiculous insults, I mean, did they convince the Chinese that we are on the brink of a real serious, maybe nuclear war, and push them to move and to do something that they haven't done in the past? And so you have to honestly put that on the table. I mean, there are new things happening. I'm not saying it will solve the crisis. We can very well, by adding tough language to tough measures, you can push someone like Kim to, you know, extreme behavior, like he won't sacrifice his nuclear program to feed his people. That's not the kind of people we know govern North Korea. So we might end up with having a new famine and catastrophe in North Korea. But it's moving.
That's right. So Michael, I was talking to a former senior official yesterday who dealt with this entire dossier, and he had this nice phrase about how when you're trying to stop a rogue state developing nuclear weapons, it's always a race between sanctions and their technology. And I'm struck in Washington by a sense that actually people are losing faith that this is winnable. Do you sense in Washington that people think, you know, one more push and we'll be there, these sanctions will do it, or are people just what's the mood in terms of optimism and pessimism about stopping Kim?
Well, it's interesting that you've heard that. One thing that I've heard out of administration officials is that there is a push that the administration feels that they can actually push for denuclearization, not only to rein in and control what has already been developed, but to have them somehow take steps backwards and neutralize the threat that they've already come up with. If that were to happen, it would maybe possibly be the most startling diplomatic and military feat in modern history to have someone step back from a nuclear program. I don't know that anyone's ever done that. So this is the thing, to actually step back from that and feel that you're going to be safe. It just won't happen. So it's very important to understand what the goal of this administration actually is. And I'm not sure exactly what that goal is.
Philippe, are you pretty pessimistic that sanctions will do it?
I don't look at sanctions by themselves. I think maybe a combination of sanctions and sweet talk could end up, you know, mounting some diplomatic effort. But tough talk and tough sanctions, it's not a recipe for a peaceful solution in my mind.
And there, in the last kind of 5 seconds on North Korea, we've said a lot of tough things about Donald Trump so far today. Is there any sense that maybe actually, if you need some extraordinary leap of imagination and pragmatism to start talking, that maybe there are some good sides to Donald Trump, that his kind of lack of experience or his sort of unconventional style, he might be the guy that just decides to fly and talk to Kim?
We have to rely on his unpredictability at this point, I think.
And
I would be nicely surprised if he was like taking a plane and going to Pyongyang and have a conversation with the rocket man.
But you don't think it'll be Kissinger and Mao? That won't be the style. So I'm sure that we will come back to North Korea another week, but we should not let this week pass without noting the real tragedies caused by Mother Nature in the Western Hemisphere. So really, a terrible earthquake that hit Mexico City, 7.1 magnitude on the Richter scale. And Michael, this wasn't even the first earthquake to hit Mexico this month.
Right, the second in a month. The damage in this most recent earthquake took place mostly in Mexico City. The last count that I've heard was over 280, approaching 300 dead. You see these horrific scenes of rescuers picking by hand through rubble, trying to get to potential survivors. In one case, I think there was a little girl that they thought was in there alive and actually was not. It's gut-wrenching, it's heartbreaking, and you go to that scene and transfer it to the hurricanes and the natural disasters where you see Puerto Rico being virtually devastated, I mean, just wiped out. 100% power gone, with estimates that they're not going to see power again for 6 months. This is going to be a real test, not only for this administration, but I think for our culture in general. You know, how do we respond to these sorts of things? How do we look past our petty differences, comparatively petty differences and grievances, and say, what is our new purpose in life? Before, it was peace. You know, coming out of World War II, we wanted peace. Now, is it going to move more towards survival and a humanitarian push to save ourselves from the very world that we live in? It will be interesting to see how the world, maybe the United Nations, responds to something like this. Mm-hmm. Is it a wartime entity, or is it a peacekeeping, or is it a life-saving entity? How will we use our resources?
And Philippe, politics never disappears completely from this sort of situation. And Mexico, you can talk to Mexican politicians who will tell you that a big earthquake 25 years ago was one of the first kind of real cracks in the monopoly of the ruling party there, because they mishandled it. Mm-hmm. Is there a sense that a lot of attention is being paid in Mexico, not just to this tragedy, but also how the government handles it? And I mean, how political is this feeling now in Mexico?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think it's when you have 300 dead, it's a terrible thing, but it's not something that is unmanageable, I think, for a government when it comes from natural disasters and these kind of things happen. I don't know if the president will suffer politically from what's going on right now in Mexico.
And let's talk about the hurricanes. Clearly, there is a political aspect to that, because you have people saying, well, look, you know, climate change is real. It's caused by mankind. And it is likely, among other things, to make hurricanes more powerful, because the sea is getting warmer. That is very controversial here in America. You have Republicans who say that's completely untrue. France has some territories in the Caribbean, Martinique, Guadeloupe, which were hit very hard by the hurricane.
And unprepared.
What is the debate like in France? Are people in France instinctively thinking of this as part of the story about climate change? Is that how people respond?
I think so. They are inclined to connect everything that's going on to climate change. Maybe they are wrong, because it doesn't seem there are more hurricanes because of global warming. Maybe, as you said, they may become stronger and so more devastating. In France, it was a real political issue that there was no warning, that they did not really anticipate the path of Irma, because it was Irma that struck the
hurricane we had 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, exactly. And then the president had to fly there and pour a lot of money into the island, which is a French department.
It's kind of it's legally part of France.
Exactly,
isn't it?
it's overseas, mm-hmm. but it's a special an integral part of the national territory.
Michael, very briefly before we turn to healthcare, has there been a big live debate about climate change as a result of these hurricanes here in America?
The debate is renewed by that, but I don't think it's changed very many people's minds. I don't think it's really shifted anyone off their positions. In some of the Trump base, evolution is not settled law. So,
and Trump has no question. He has had no question to answer at all. I'm even surprised that even if you can argue that it's not directly connected, mm-hmm. that with all those hurricanes in mm-hmm. this season, there was not one question Trump had to answer about that.
And climate change didn't come into his UN speech either, which was striking. Let's turn to the city where we're sitting now. Very close to this studio is Capitol Hill, the Congress. The Senate is having one last go, or they say one last, maybe another. But they have the chance, if they can pass a law by the end of September, then there is a kind of procedure that they only need 51 votes if they can do it by the end of September. So this is a big chance for them to try and knock away that health law that was a big plank of Barack Obama's agenda. Does the Senate look as though it has the votes? And how much of a test is this, Michael, of the Republicans' ability to get stuff done?
Well, you have sort of this manic quality, to the Republican Party right now. You're trying to figure out what they ought to do, what's most important, and they're acting as if the clock is ticking. We have to do health care right now, tax reform right now, immigration right now, and the plates are spinning, and they seem to not be able to decide what's really important. But the one thing is that they keep imposing all these artificial deadlines on getting settled law done. Look, we're talking about with health care, 1/6 of the American economy, fully 1/6 of the American economy, and they have, again, with Lindsey Graham and Bill Cassidy, had a small group of people who have initiated an effort to change this healthcare system without going through regular order. Why not take it through committees? Why not take it through debate? Why not take it through the amendment process, just like every other significant piece of legislation in this country has been done, and let that work? Otherwise, you're going to get legislation that's going to be held hostage until you get the next majority in, which will immediately flip it over.
And Philippe, tell us about the relationship between President Trump and Republicans in Congress. Does Donald Trump believe that a kind of a conservative ideology means that a certain kind of health law is the right kind of small government, spend less money approach, and he's absolutely united with his party on Capitol Hill about this, or does it feel a bit odder and a bit different?
It's definitely odder and different. I don't see many issues on which Donald Trump is in real agreement with his party. On this issue of healthcare, what strikes me is that both in the White House and in the Congress, you have this strange feeling that so many people don't know what they are doing, and they don't know what they want to achieve. And they even seem not to know precisely how the system works, because they are not able to anticipate the consequences of their laws. I mean, they have to wait for the CBO, and we discover that 23, 24 million people would lose their coverage, that the last law would deprive states from $184 billion and giving more money to the states who don't want it, like Texas. I mean, this is really upside down in terms of making sensible policies.
It's politics where it ought to be policy. We don't have enough policy people involved in the situation.
Well, that's all the time we have. And thank you to Michael Williams, CBS Radio news contributor, and Philippe Gély, the chief U.S. correspondent for Le Figaro, the French daily newspaper here in Washington. This program was produced by Rebecca Ward. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. And I'm David Rennie, Washington bureau chief for The Economist. Thanks for listening.